From the University of Texas at Austin, KUT Radio, this is In Black America.
When I was 8 years old, Martin Luther King was killed, and I remember feeling, what can we do? And I remember feeling, you know, how unfair it was. And so ever since then, I've always had this little thing gnawing at me to do something. And I had an opportunity to write a book on racism, and that book came out. And much of what's in that book is, you know, I didn't even, had not ever learned. And I just, you know, at the time, and it's gotten so much worse, but at the time, you know, there's so much, there's always been division. We've all dealt with racism all our life, but it was just an opportunity that presented itself to me. And I wanted to write something that could bring people together, because my church was very diverse. My family's very diverse. I've always lived in a diverse world and been in the middle and been a unifier without even realizing it. And I wanted to write something to help people and give people tools on how to be unified. And it's based on our similarities. In our culture, we have this us versus them culture. And it's either, you know, you're for or against Black Lives, you're for or against the police, you're Republican or Democrat, Fox or CNN.
Pastor Miles McPherson, former NFL defensive back, pastor of the Rock Church in San Diego, California, and author of The Third Option, Hope for a Racially Divided Nation, published by Howard Books. At its core, The Third Option is a comprehensive and widely relevant approach for anyone looking to engage in conversation about race. It has been used to develop a training program rolling out in the next few months. It has been used in prison, corporate offices, and similar communities across the nation. McPherson is solution-based while speaking about race with an underlying thread of hope. What he offered differently is a cultural voice that can distinctly speak to police brutality from a perspective of an African-American son of a police officer and father of a police detective, kneeling from the perspective of an NFL athlete, and the faith-based perspective of a megachurch pastor. McPherson not only has talked the talk, he has walked the walk. I'm Johnny O. Henson, Jr., and welcome to another edition of In Black America. On this week's program, The Third Option with Pastor Miles McPherson, In Black America.
The Third Option is designed to give people tools on how to acknowledge blind spots in their life, how to build bridges and honor the similarities we have. And one of those is the fact that we have blind spots. There's things we don't know. And now I have a 6-session e-course that is designed with, that's equipped with teaching, participants guide, role plays, live Q&A, Zoom interviews with experts and celebrities. And so this e-course, which you can get at milesmcpherson.com, this e-course is designed to help people go through these lessons about blind spots, about being a brother's keeper, how to have a race consultation, not a race conversation. But when people say they don't see color, they're exercising a blind spot, not realizing how the person they're talking to is going to receive it.
In his book, The Third Option, Pastor Miles McPherson focuses on the issue of racism and offers unique solution to bias and inequality. Released in 2018, the book has seen a resurgence in the last few months. Throughout the book, McPherson challenges us to look beyond the us versus them mindset, encouraging us to seek a third option, celebrating what we have in common rather than focusing on our differences. Some main takeaways including identifying common racial blind spots, honorable versus dishonorable knee-jerk assumptions, and firsthand conversations and personal anecdotes from those directly affected by racism and those seeking to understand it. Born in Brooklyn and raised on Long Island, New York, McPherson experienced firsthand how racism plays out in a multiracial child from both sides. Recently, In Black America spoke with Pastor Miles McPherson.
Well, like every other city, you know, we're open, then we're closed. We're open, then the closed. As far as the church, we haven't had in-person church since March. So we're completely online and people are adjusting. We're having a lot of small group discussions online. You know, I have a small group. We have, you know, a bunch of small groups around the county. But as far as having church together in the sanctuary, we haven't been able to do that since March.
Now, how has that affected? I understand that you all have some satellite churches as part of the major church?
Yeah, so we have seven, what we call seven campuses, but one of those campuses was the online campus. And but there are, you know, five buildings around San Diego, then a bunch of portable sites around the county. But now everyone's online, so that's what we're doing.
How is the church assisting the community?
Oh, that's what we specialize in, because we do that every year anyway. We give about $4 million of volunteer service every year to our city. And this year, since COVID, we repaired 300,000 N95 masks. We've been feeding people in the community, whether at our campuses or bringing food to first responders, 911 call center, the hospitals, the nurses, the police. And so we're constantly doing that anyway. So we just now focused on things that are COVID related.
Now, you pastor a multi-ethnic church, and there's been a lot of conversation about the disparities in minority communities. Are you seeing that so in San Diego with the minorities there?
Yes and no. I mean, in California and San Diego, it's not as bad as in other cities. We understand and we are aware of that disparity, but San Diego numbers seem to be somewhat consistent with our demographic.
Now, you were born in New York, and you have two brothers and one sister. Tell us, what was life like growing up in Queens?
Well, I actually was born in Brooklyn, and then I grew up in Long Island.
Okay.
I lived in Queens for like 6 months, and then I grew up in Long Island. You know what I'm saying? I grew up in Long Island. I grew up in a place called Lakeview that was, I was born in 60, so it was segregated. So it was mostly black there. And then I went to school for the first 8 years, a place called Malvern that was mostly white, and got harassed in Malvern because I was black, got harassed in Lakeview where I lived because I wasn't black enough because my grandmother's white, and my other grandmother's half black and Chinese. All my grandparents are from Jamaica. And so I had this international family, but grew up with, you know, being harassed everywhere I went, kind of feeling like an outsider until I got on the football team. And then we all kind of came together, even though it was a black and white team. You know, we had a common goal and a common enemy, the other team, and a common goal to win. So football has been a big savior for me.
I read that at 10, you began, I guess, soon playing football at a young age, and you were a running back. When did you realize that you could take your talent to the next level?
You know, I probably realized that when it happened. You know, all your life, you're like, I'm going to go to NFL. You know, but every kid is saying that, right? And so you always have this, you know, little doubt in your mind. I went to a Division III football school, so that even increased the doubt because I didn't get any scholarships to go to a Division I school. Part of that reason was my school, we ran out of money and we had no film. After three games, they canceled the season. Then they restarted the season. So we had a really bad situation at a high school. However, when I was in college, you know, I just kept saying I was going to go to NFL. And my coach made a flyer and sent to every NFL team my senior year. Nobody came to watch me play. And then after the season, some teams came out and watched film, and I got drafted. So my dad bet me $100 I was going to get drafted because I didn't think I would, and I did. So I was the first player drafted out of University of New Haven. It was Division III for my first 3 years, and then we went to Division II. So it was a real small school.
Yeah, I was going to ask you about attending the University of New Haven. Did they recruit you, or you just attended that on your own?
Well, it was Division III, and a friend of mine had referred me to them.
Okay.
So it was really no recruitment. I just, you know, you walk on. There was no scholarship, and the football program was very, very new at the time.
Now, you were initially drafted by the Rams. Tell us about that day.
Oh, I was at my friend's house in New Haven, and they called his house. And, you know, they told me they were going to call me, and I didn't believe them, and they did. And I thought it was, you know, a prank because they asked for my mother's name and address because they wanted to send the flowers. And I'm like, who's playing this joke on me? And then the scout that scouted me got on the phone, and then the coach got on the phone, and it was one of the best days of my life.
Now, you played four seasons in the NFL. Give us a snapshot of those times.
Well, my first 2 years, I was using cocaine. I was just as wild as I could be. And then I asked Jesus to be my savior after my second year and stopped doing cocaine in one day. And the next year, I was a starter. I got hurt. Then I played one more year. But those are the years I started to learn about God and Jesus in my life and the Bible, and I went right into ministry after that.
And tell us about the Miles Ahead Youth Crusade. I think that was one of the first organizations, the group that you formed once you started your ministries.
Yeah, man, 30 years ago, we used to do Youth Crusade. I mean, I don't even, I think it was 30 years, no, we used to, maybe 25, mm-hmm. 25 years ago, we started doing Youth Crusades. We've done about 16 around the world. And it was just a free event to, you know, music and testimonies, and then I would preach the gospel. And it was focused on teenagers. And we've had them in the United States, Canada, Caribbean, Africa. And they were very successful, very stressful, and very fruitful.
Now, if you've written two other books, but your current book, which came out in I think 2018, The Third Option, Hope for a Racially Divided Nation, what led you to put your thoughts down on paper?
When I was 8 years old, Martin Luther King was killed, and I remember feeling, what can we do? And I remember feeling, you know, how unfair it was. And so ever since then, I've always had this little thing gnawing at me to do something. And I had an opportunity to write a book on racism, and that book came out. And much of what's in that book is, you know, I didn't even, had not ever learned. And I just, you know, at the time, and it's gotten so much worse, but at the time, you know, there's always been division. We've all dealt with racism all our life, but it was just an opportunity that presented itself to me. And I wanted to write something that could bring people together, because my church was very diverse. My family's very diverse. I've always lived in a diverse world and been in the middle and been a unifier without even realizing it. And I wanted to write something to help people and give people tools on how to be unified. And it's based on our similarities. In our culture, we have this us versus them culture. And it's either, you know, you're for or against Black Lives, you're for or against the police, you're Republican or Democrat, Fox or CNN. And everything's about us versus them. And once you pick one side, you inevitably become the enemy of the other side. And once you pick a side, if you agree with someone on the other side, you're a sellout and they cancel you. And that's not going to get us anywhere. So the third option is, how do we bring honor to the things that we have in common? Because all of us are more similar than different. All people on earth are 99.5% genetically identical. We all love our sleep, our food. We all bleed red. We all have the same organs. We all want to have a loving family, live in safe neighborhoods. And so we share so many things. And if we can identify those things and bring our uniqueness to the table and bring our unique perspective to the table on those issues that we share, I think that's how we're going to move forward and bring unity to a culture.
We'll be back with more In Black America after this message. And now back to this episode of In Black America. Now, you've had a vantage point of seeing both sides of the picture, being that your father was an undercover officer in New York and your son is a detective out there in San Diego. How are these conversations playing out in your household?
Well, my dad's passed, but my dad was right. He was in internal affairs. Well, first he started with patrol, then detective, mm-hmm. then internal affairs in New York. So, you know, he's experienced racism. Let me back up. Police are people.
Right.
And there's no group that wants anyone to say all of y'all are bad or mm-hmm. all of y'all are good. And whether you have Black, white, police, doctors, pastors, we're all flawed. And some of us make worse mistakes than others. And so my son and I, my relationship with the police in San Diego is very close. We all acknowledge that we want police that are going to do the right thing. We want police that are going to keep us safe and be honorable. So that's not a difficult conversation or something of point of disagreement. Mm-hmm. I think even the police will tell you they don't like the bad police. And right. So I think it's just a matter of how we handle that conversation without categorizing everyone with a broad brush, which no one wants.
With the current state of racial strife, why is it difficult, in your opinion, that we have yet to have a conversation on race that, as you earlier stated, that is it me versus them in that conversation, and we never get to the root cause of the disagreement?
Well, I can't say why the reason is. I will tell you the reason that we have racism in the first place is because of the pride of man. You know, racism, mm-hmm. okay. by definition is when you see someone that's less human than you, as less human than you, or their image of God in them is less than yours. Or you know, so because of that, and we do that for many reasons. We do that because of color. We do that, you know, in Africa, it's black on black, but it's a tribal thing. In India, it's a caste thing. And so we all find reasons to put people below us because they make less money or they have an accent or they're just born in a different country. And it really stems from the pride of man trying to elevate themselves over someone else. And so in order for there to be unity, people have to humble themselves before each other and say, look, you are as good as me, or you are as made in the image of God, just like I am, and you deserve what I deserve. And it's going to require people to humble themselves and acknowledge that maybe others are as blessed and gifted as them and have the same level of humanity as them and have and others to forgive. And that conversation is often difficult to have.
What do you say when people tell you that they don't see color?
Yeah, I have a whole talk on that. I tell them this. Why are you saying that to me? Because mm-hmm. the only time they say it is when they say, you know, the first time someone told me that, I thought they had an eye astigmatism because I had never heard that. Right. And I was confused. And I said, well, you don't see blue, red. They said, no, I see that. I just don't see your color. I said, well, how do you know I have a color you shouldn't see? There's no way you can't see color. Even if you close your eyes, you see black. And so I tell them that even though their intent is to build a bridge, the impact is a fence. And that's the definition of a blind spot. You know, when I teach in my book, that the book is designed, the third option is designed to give people tools on how to acknowledge blind spots in their life, how to build bridges and honor the similarities we have. And one of those is the fact that we have blind spots. There's things we don't know. And now I have a 6-session e-course that is designed that's equipped with teaching, a participant's guide, role plays, live Q&A, Zoom interviews with experts and celebrities. And so this e-course, which you can get at milesandfearson.com, this e-course is designed to help people go through these lessons about blind spots, about being a brother's keeper, how to have a race consultation, not a race conversation, which mm-hmm. I can talk about in a minute. But when people say they don't see color, they're exercising a blind spot, not realizing how the person they're talking to is going to receive it.
I found it interesting when you talk about when people go to Hawaii and get a tan and celebrate it, and when you're born with a tan in the womb, it's invalidated.
Exactly. So people go to Hawaii and they change the color of their skin, which is kind of comical. You lay out for hours to get brown, right. Yet you criticize brown. But, you know, those... no one gets a tan. I've never, ever, ever, ever heard of someone getting a tan and then claim they didn't see it or claim they didn't want someone else to see it. They get it so it could be seen. They show it off. But yet when someone gets a tan in the womb, all of a sudden we don't want to see it. And so, you know, we just need to step back. And again, the book is designed to help people to step back and think, how can I be more honoring and place value on the similarities that we have? One of those similarities that I want to be noticed just like you want to be noticed. I want to be heard just like you want to be heard. I want to be respected just like you want to be respected. And that's what the book is designed. And the e-course is designed to help people go through together, best in groups, and have these discussions. Matter of fact, I piloted this e-course with the police, members of the police and members of the community. And the police loved it because it helped them look inside their heart. And these were their words to me. It helped them look inside their heart instead of just being told, don't do this, don't say this. It was more of a journey of self-reflection.
Talk to us about race consultation, because you alluded to it in your previous answer.
Yeah, so because we see color, every person in every conversation is having a race conversation. If two African-Americans are talking, they know they're talking to black people. Mm-hmm. And it's not that. That's just a fact. It's like, you know, you're talking to a woman, you know, you're talking to someone with a blue shirt. It's just is. It's not racist to think that. It's just factual. You know, when you see a red rose or green or a blue rose or whatever, but and you have that race conversation in your head. The problem is when you make assumptions about someone based on what you see and you apply them to that person as fact versus having a race consultation where you allow them to self-disclose to you who they are and what they are. And if when we see people, instead of saying, oh, that's a thug, or that's a white privilege, or that's an illegal, that we say, I want to find out who that person is and what their life is about, what we have in common. And if we give people opportunity to share who they are, give them opportunity to get us opportunity to get to know them, we would have better relationships. The other thing I talk about is labels. If you label someone with a dehumanizing label, like a thug, or immigrant or illegal, then you limit how well what you could ever see in them. And you limit how much you can love them and the quality of your love. So you got to give them an honoring, loving label that is equivalent to how you see yourself. So the Bible says, love your neighbor as yourself. And so if you love yourself, you know, you give them a label that's consistent with the God image that they carry.
Why was it important for you to include prayers at the, each of your chapters?
We need God. You know, you asked me earlier about, well, this, why is there so much racism? It said, you know, we're selfish and we need God to soften our heart and humble our heart and bring us together and to be able to see each other as he sees us. And so I want people to pray, because, you know, when you're reading a book like this, sometimes you're going to be, you know, hearing things about yourself and things that you believe that may be challenging and discouraging and or difficult to face. And so we're going to need God to get over that hump in our life.
Now, I'm glad you stated that. Also in the book, it's not just your thoughts, but also in the book, you allow the readers at certain points to reassess themselves. How did you come up with that concept?
You know, I'm only responsible for me. I can't be responsible for you. And so when I wrote this, it's like, look, I'm going to put some information in the book, but in the end, you have to make your decision. You have to decide that you're going to face what's in your heart. That's why prayer is so important, to let God search my heart. You know, we are all, and myself included, we're all more prideful than we think. We're all more wrong than we think. And it's not until we individually accept that there's things we got to learn that we don't know that we will, that'll happen. And so my prayer is that people would self-reflect on all of this and just be responsible for themselves, because that's the only person you're responsible for.
Now, Martin Luther King stated it, but you also wrote about in the book, at 11 o'clock in America is the most segregated time in America. Why is it important, particularly in your congregation, that these different facets come together on Sunday morning and worship together?
Well, you know, the church is supposed to be the carrier of the message of love and unity. Mm-hmm. And, you know, that's something that we need to do. And on Sunday morning, people go to church and they, you know, they praise God and they talk about loving people, but then they avoid people and they don't want to even talk about reconciliation and justice. And we serve a God of justice. We serve a God of love. We serve a God of reconciliation. So there's a disconnect. Now, I get some people like certain preaching and certain music and all that, but the result of our going to church, the result needs to be that we come together and live and model to the world unity, because in heaven it's going to be diverse. Mm-hmm. And so it's important for us to understand the mandate that God gave us to love our neighbor as ourselves.
What do you think brought us to this current climate where the masses in this country and across the world are rejecting some of the actions that are being taken by police departments?
Well, I mean, I don't know that the actions of the dishonorable actions and the illegal actions were ever accepted.
The protesters are now responding to some of the things that have been occurring. They have always been occurring, but now everybody got video phones, so you're able to see actually for yourself what's been happening, but the response to all that.
Yeah, and I think that's the answer. I mean, the seeing it on video, and obviously the killing of George Floyd was the straw that broke the camel's back. But it also broke it for a lot of whites as well. Mm-hmm. Who were in denial for a long time, saying, well, this stuff is not real, or, you know, that person shouldn't have been there. But when they saw George Floyd, they're like, okay, we can't we can't rationalize that one away. So that was the tipping point for a lot of people.
Do you see light at the end of the tunnel?
You know, whatever the devil means for evil, God turns into good if his people do the right thing. Mm-hmm. And so the light at the end of the tunnel will only happen if God's people do the right thing, because it's going to require the power of God. Do I see the right thing if people just kind of, you know, do what they want to do? Probably not. I'm hopeful, but it's so hard to, we need a miracle, because it's been, you know, it's been around since the beginning of time, and it has to do with power and man, you know, pride. And so I'm praying and you know, making the mission to me to write the book and to make the write the e-course and develop the e-course so people can, you know, go through the classes and go on this journey of self-discovery with the third option e-course. And so I'm doing everything I can to get people to take this journey of self-reflection and transformation.
I would be remiss if I didn't ask this question before ending the conversation about one of my favorite ministers and one of your ministers, T.D. Jakes. Why is he important to you and what you do?
Well, Bishop Jakes is important to about everybody I know. You know, Bishop Jakes, long story, my mother died a few years ago, and mm-hmm. Bishop was extremely, extremely instrumental in ministering to me. We had met a little bit before that, but that was when we, you know, kind of bonded, and mm-hmm. he was there for me. I mean, he was on the phone. He spent so many hours on the phone just talking to me, ministering to me at different times, and we became friends, and then he loved this message. And so he was instrumental in helping launch the book and let me speak at his church. And I always tell people he's probably one of the smartest people I know. And so I lean on him for a lot of wisdom and encouragement, and hopefully, you know, I'm a blessing to him as well.
Last question, Pastor. What enduring message would you like to tell our listeners?
Get the third option. You know, as long as we fight the us versus them battle, we are going to be divided. And as long as we're saying, I have to be right and you have to be wrong, we're going to be divided. But if we say there's a third option where we can come together and take our discussion and discourse to a high level and focus on what we agree on, we can come together. So I would say get the third option.
Pastor Miles McPherson, former NFL defensive back, pastor of the Rock Church in San Diego, and author of The Third Option, Hope for a Racially Divided Nation. If you have questions, comments, or suggestions as to future In Black America programs, email us at inblackamerica@kut.org. Also, let us know what radio station you heard us over. Don't forget to subscribe to our podcast and follow us on Facebook. You can hear previous programs online at kut.org. Also, you can listen to a special collection of In Black America programs at American Archives of Public Broadcasting. That's AmericanArchives.org. The views and opinions expressed on this program are not necessarily those of this station or of the University of Texas at Austin. Until we have the opportunity again for technical producer David Alvarez, I'm Johnny O. Henson, Jr. Thank you for joining us today. Please join us again next week.
CD copies of this program are available and may be purchased by writing In Black America CDs, KUT Radio, 300 West Dean Keaton Boulevard, Austin, Texas, 78712. That's In Black America CDs, KUT Radio, 300 West Dean Keaton Boulevard, Austin, Texas, 78712. This has been a production of KUT Radio.